Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. This episode's guest, Kevin Robbins, is a professor at the University of Texas Austin School of Journalism and the author of Harvey Pienick, The Life and Wisdom of the Man Who Wrote the Book on Golf. Let's start with this. Let's just say that I have a friend, okay? That's all I'm going to give you right now. I have a friend who's a 25 to 30 handicap. He's been playing golf, you know, since his father bought him clubs in the sixth or seventh grade. He hasn't gotten any better since that time. He's a mid to late 30s, father of two now. Again, this is just a friend.
Yeah.
What sort of advice would Harvey Pienick give this friend of mine to, let's say, improve his handicap by five strokes? Because, again, I'm not looking to break any sort of records here. I just want to get a little bit better.
Your friend, as you
mean. My friend. Right.
So, okay, let me get this. Let's walk back a little bit. Your
okay.
friend has two children. Did I hear that?
Yes, they're adorable, but they are under the age of five. Yes.
That makes all the difference. Because I was once a father of two young children under five, and coincidentally, I noticed a kind of a severe stoppage in my ability to not only play golf but practice golf. But let's just assume that the children aren't a factor here, and that we're just talking about golf.
Right. I'm not. Again, I'm not trying to assign any blame for my friend here.
So I think the first thing that Harvey would do with this speculative friend is spend an inordinate amount of time on and around a practice green, because Harvey always taught golf from the hole out, and especially when introducing someone to the game for the first time, he would start literally with short putts. Because Harvey believed a great deal in success built through confidence. And so if you think about that, John, like, he would start his students with these short putts, and he wanted them to get accustomed to the idea of balls going in the hole, which is, you know, the goal of golf. And he believed that once people experienced that, you know, brief pleasure and confidence through holding the ball, that moving out from the hole would produce joy in golf. And so I think he would ask your friend to spend a lot of time making short putts, 5 feet, then 8 feet, then 12, gradually moving out to short chips off the green to pitches, up to about 100 yards. And I think that Harvey would want to spend maybe 6 months just with that idea of hitting short scoring shots.
So the friend is obviously me, and thanks to you and Harvey Pienick for the advice. And what you've described, is so interesting to me, because so much about golf is much more than just a sport. It's a labor of love, and it requires time. And what I was struck by with your story and the story of Harvey Pienick and his little red book is that, you know, he looked at the golfer as an individual, and you know, there's no prescription for each and every person. And when you approach as a teacher, you know this as a teacher, when you approach your subjects as an individual, it helps you to tailor the message that much more convincingly and effectively. So I thought that was very refreshing in reading about Harvey Pienick in your book.
That's a really great point. And one of the things that Harvey emphasized was this sort of pre-lesson interview with his subjects as well. So if you came to him, say, for the first time, you wouldn't go directly out to the range or to the chipping green. Harvey would want to spend some time in his in his pro shop with you, and he would want to ask you about your goals in golf. He would want to ask you about distractions in your life, what might be getting in the way of your getting better. He would want to, and he did this with Hal Sutton when Hal Sutton was a teenager in Shreveport, Louisiana. He would want to, he'd ask you to pick up a club, and he'd want to see your grip, your natural grip, and he'd want to see your natural stance, the relationship of your body to the golf club, to the ball. A lot of things would happen before you actually traipsed out to outside to actually do real golf.
So I wonder how much of his patience and his effectiveness as a communicator came from the fact that he was a lifelong golfer. I mean, he played the game from a young age on, and he was very good, right? I mean, let's not mince words. Harvey Pinnock could play the game of golf, but he never reached the pinnacle of the game as a player. And so I was struck by, and I think this is something that's common in all sports, not just golf, that oftentimes the most effective teachers or coaches in sports are those that aren't necessarily the best players, because sometimes there's that lack of patience and frustration that grows with the great players when they become coaches, because they wonder why their pupils can't execute the plan as they would. And I wonder if you think a lot of what Pinnock's success, a lot of where his success came from, was this, that he wasn't the best player. He was a great player. I mean, much better than my friend who I described earlier. But he wasn't the best. He didn't reach the top of his sport. And I wonder if you think that's part of what made him an effective teacher of the game.
Yeah, it could be. He was a spectacular player.
Sorry.
He played in the precursor tournaments to the PGA Tour in Texas, including the early Texas Opens in San Antonio. He qualified for and played in the 1928 U.S. Open at Olympia Fields in Chicago. And he probably could have carved out a pretty nice, well, such as it was back then, a pretty nice career playing golf. I mean, back then, let's be candid, nobody was making a living playing full-time golf. But Harvey could have sketched one out. I think, though, that he found his true calling in helping people to become better at golf through what he learned observing the game since he was 8 years old and a caddy at the early Austin Country Club. Everything Harvey knew about golf was from what he watched and saw and thought about. He, you know, Harvey had a high school education. He wasn't what you would consider an educated man. He wasn't a worldly person. He devoted his life singularly to the study of golf, and by his reckoning, that study was cause and effect. What did he see in a student, and what did that particular action, flawed or not, produce? And so if, for example, he would watch somebody like Hogan or Byron Nelson or Mickey Wright, whose golf swing he adored, they were probably as close to perfect as we'll ever see. And so he would note what actions produced their ball flight and their consistency and their accuracy. And that would sort of appear on one side of the imaginary ledger. And then he'd watch somebody like me or your speculative friend or the many, many other Austin Country Club members he enjoyed teaching so much. And he would look at what poor action would produce their poor shots. And he would note that on the other side of the imaginary ledger. And so he knew what caused bad shots and he knew what caused good ones. And that's how he taught.
Do you think that I don't want to say that Harvey Pinnock was, I guess we could describe Harvey Pinnock as perhaps a bridge to the modern day golf instructors. I'm sure the Butch Harmons, the Sean Foleys, you know, all these guys who are on the ranges today at these PGA events, you know, owe some of their you know, profession to Pinnock's wisdom and his teachings. But do you think there's a little too much teaching going on nowadays. When you look at some of these pros, I mean, they amass a team of people around them, and it seems like some of these so-called swing experts are more there to kind of manage the mental side of the game as much as they are the swing. Do you think that pendulum has gone too far? And what do you think Harvey Pinnick would think of the driving ranges of PGA Tour events today with all of these coaches in the ears of these professionals?
I love that question, John, and it's one I thought about a lot doing this project. What would Harvey say if exposed to the state of the game now? I don't know, unfortunately, is the answer to your question, if the pendulum has swung too far. But I think that we can draw a really good example from Tom Kite and Ben Crenshaw, who grew up in Austin together. They started playing together as teenagers at Austin Country Club. Their families both were members at the club. And Harvey taught both of those guys distinctly differently because they needed two different things from golf. And they enjoyed really two different things from golf. Crenshaw was a player. Kite was a practicer. And that sort of remains even today in their somewhat limited careers now. So when Crenshaw came to the golf course, Harvey would give him a sleeve of balls and send him out to the first tee. When Kite came to the golf course, they marched directly to the range and they exhausted bucket after bucket on the range. Tom Kite wanted to know why certain things happened with the golf ball when you did certain things with your swing. Crenshaw didn't really care. Crenshaw just wanted to go out and have fun and watch the ball fly through the air. So, you know, I think the question becomes, if you look at a PGA Tour range today on a Wednesday, how many of those players out there like watching the ball fly through the air and don't really care about, you know, the physics of why it happens? And how many of those players want to know exactly why the motion of their golf swing produces a certain kind of ball flight and need to know that broken down to like the granular level? I think there are, you know, players of both types out there, but I think there are fewer now who just enjoy watching the ball fly through the air. I mean, I remember hearing or reading a quote from Arnold Palmer once, and it was something to the effect of the pleasure that I get from watching a golf ball soar through the air is the same pleasure that some people get from standing in front of a painting at an art museum and looking at it for an hour. And there's a real beauty and romance to that. And that's what appeals to me about golf. That's what appealed to Ben Crenshaw about golf on some level. That's what appealed to Harvey about golf. But I wonder, as I look at a PGA Tour range, how many guys out there are like Arnold and Ben Crenshaw in that way?
Well, one who is, at least we're told that he is, if you watch golf and you follow the sport closely, you know, Bubba Watson is kind of this savant in a way, this swing savant who has, you know, allegedly, and I say allegedly because he says he's never taken a lesson once in his life. Yep. And that is highly uncommon, and he might be the only pro who hasn't grown up through the ranks without taking some sort of formal golf lesson. And I wonder what someone like a Harvey Pinnick would have thought about a Bubba Watson. And in a way, I think, you know, say what you want about Bubba's occasional petulant attitude, I find it refreshing that he plays the game based on instinct, because that puts him squarely in our corner as the amateur, you know, where, you know, we don't go out and get lessons as frequently as some of these guys who are on the courses on the weekends do. It's easier to relate to a guy like Bubba Watson. And I wonder what Harvey Pinnick would think about certainly he would have loved his game and the ability to shape shots, but the idea that he's never been coached, I wonder what Harvey Pinnick would think.
That's also an interesting question. Bubba's a complicated character, and I empathize with him on a lot of levels, and I admire him a great deal. I wish he comported himself a little better publicly, because then he'd be sort of irrefutable. But back to Harvey, I think that Bubba would give Harvey great joy, because I think Bubba does play just for the thrill of playing. And if you look at Bubba's setup, and his grip, and those are the things that matter to Harvey. Like three things mattered to him. He wanted to see how you stood over the ball. He wanted to see where you were aimed, and he knew all of the points on your body that mattered to aim. And he wanted to see how you held the club. Harvey felt like if you got those three variables right according to the way that you swung the club, that you had much of the battle won. And so, when I look at Bubba stand over the ball, and I've seen Bubba up close. I used when I was doing golf writing for the American Statesman newspaper in Austin. I had a PGA Tour credential, so I could go out on the range and I could watch these guys, which I very much enjoyed doing and which I miss a lot now. And I would take a great thrill in watching Bubba practice, such as he did, because he just looks so great over the ball. He's got a great body for golf. He's got nice long arms. He's very limber. Huge power. And I think Harvey would admire that too. And I think that Bubba's one of those guys he would kind of leave alone. Bubba's one of those guys he would give a sleeve of balls to in the pro shop and say, go play. They would not spend a great deal of time on the range.
And so much about, the game today, and you mentioned, you started when you started talking about Bubba Watson, you mentioned how he comports himself on the course, after rounds. I think there's something there that bothers a lot of us. But I wonder, the game of golf has this code, right? And that this code of golf, I think, is very polarizing to fans and casual observers. To fans, we just kind of accept it as part of the sport. I don't perhaps know as much about the code as other fans do. But to casual observers of the sport or people who are just getting into the game, I think this unwritten code of golf, where it's about more than the sport, it's about the attitude, about the self-policing. That I don't want to say it rubs people the wrong way, but they're suspicious of what they don't know. And was Harvey Pienick someone who embodied this code in his teaching of the game? Did he very much believe in these? I mean, he wrote a lot of rules of the game as far as the swing goes, but did he believe in these unwritten rules of golf in regards to, attitude, the way you carry yourself and things of that nature?
Yeah, he did. As far as I can tell, Harvey, this was his profession. And I think that he had high expectations of the people who wanted to play this game. He believed very much in the rules of golf, and he believed very much in etiquette as well. In his later years, after he was really sort of unable to teach day in and day out because he was old and his health was starting to suffer, he was the starter on the first tee at Austin Country Club, and he would sit out at the first hole in a golf cart. He would check in players and note the names of the guests, and he would admonish groups to not take mulligans because he believed that if you took a mulligan on the first hole, that your round was invalid. And even if you hit a poor tee shot, let's say you hit one in the woods, he would encourage you to go play that ball because you never knew what might happen after that. So maybe you make a bogey or a double on the first hole, but what if you birdie the next four and you get on this nice swing of momentum and you post a career round? But it's a valid career round if you played that first ball instead of taking a mulligan. Now, I should be careful to say that he didn't lecture people about this, and he very much wanted people to enjoy golf on their own terms. But deep inside, he was very black and white about the rules of golf. So I think the answer to your question is, yeah, he had high expectations of people who played the game. He considered it an honorable game, And yes, he did. He had those high expectations.
But he was also interested in watching the game grow, correct? I mean, he wanted to see this sport expand and become more and more popular and played by as many people as possible, at least I assume. So that leaves me wondering, you know, what an old schooler, I call him an old schooler, that's not entirely fair. He's just, you know, he got older in life. I mean,
He's an old schooler.
Old schooler. Okay, we call him an old schooler. But what an old schooler like a Harvey Pienick would think about, you know, recently there's been, it's so silly, it's so stupid, I don't even want to call it controversy, but Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler and Smiley Kaufman and Justin Thomas went on a spring break.
Down there in Bahamas, right?
Right. This is all over the place right now, right? They went down to the Bahamas. They had a great time. They were on the beach for a week. They were tweeting pictures and Snapchatting pictures of tequila and resorts. And they were playing shirtless golf with flip-flops on. And they were having a great time. And the whole story was chronicled on Snapchat. And obviously now there's this blowback where you have golf writers, established golf writers. I think it was Jeff Shackelford who went on his website and I don't want to say admonished their character, but he said, hey, this might not be good for the game. And I have personal problems with that because, you know, I think for young people to connect with the sport, these types of things aren't necessarily bad. Having a cell phone on the course, you or I wouldn't do that. But, you know, you play with kids, high schoolers that bring their cell phones on the course, that tweet pictures of their shots. Hey, if that's what keeps them from, you know, keeps them coming out and playing more rounds of golf, isn't that good for the sport? And I don't even want to imagine what an old schooler like Harvey Pienick would think. But I mean, would you agree that it's good or bad, or what would you say, good or bad for the sport?
Wow, I have so many answers. I first should say that, you know, I know Jeff Shackelford and I respect him a great deal. I think it's only bad for the, I think in, it could be perceived as bad for the game only by those who saw it on the internet, right? Like if this wasn't on the internet, is it bad for the game? I don't think so. When I was playing a lot of golf, can't tell you how many times my group, we'd play an E9 and we'd just make up silly, crazy games. And in fact, I played with a guy frequently back in the early part of the 2000s who played the last three holes barefooted. That's just like that was who he was. And it was hilarious. And he would always press bets late in the round with his shoes off. And sometimes he lost them and sometimes he won them. And it was hysterical either way. I think, you know, people who play golf, they need to find what they like about it, what they enjoy most about it. And I think a lot of us, we have different personifications of that. So I used to play competitive golf. I used to play in qualifiers at the state and national level. I mean, you know, I had a certain demeanor playing those, a certain identity playing those. But then the very next week, playing the Saturday Skins game with the guy who took his shoes off in the last three holes, I had a completely different demeanor there too. So it's clearly the four guys in the Bahamas, they have different demeanors as well. I thought it was hysterical, and I found, you know, so much pleasure in watching those guys slap it around down in the Bahamas because, you know, I saw a little bit of myself there. I don't know what Harvey would think of that. I think maybe privately it would give him a little smile. I think that as you noted, he wanted people to enjoy the game that meant so much to him, whatever that meant to individuals. I don't know if he was concerned about the growth of the game or even the sustenance of the game as much as he wanted people to share the same pleasure that he got out of it. So I think he'd be okay with that, John.
Yeah, and all I was trying to argue for here was that sometimes I think the honor and the code turns potential golf lovers away from the sport at first.
I think that's a good point.
And I don't see anything wrong with going out on the course and enjoying yourself. And I don't see anything wrong with watching others go out on the course and enjoy themselves. And, you know, my 5-year-old son loves watching golf. I know it's amazing, but there's something so soothing about it for him. He can just prop himself up on the couch and he loves watching golf. And Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, you know, these are guys who he knows their names. He knows when they come on the television. He knows who they are. And I love that name recognition. I love that he's aware of who they are. And I would have no problem with my five-year-old son also watching some of their antics. I'd have a problem with my five-year-old son on Snapchat, but I would have no problem with my five-year-old son watching some of their antics on a Bahamas golf course, because frankly, I've done that. You've done that. I mean, I want my son to grow up and do that because it's fun. Sports are supposed to be fun. And sometimes we take the sport too seriously, and it bothers me as a golf fan, because I think the game's meant to be enjoyed, and I don't really have a problem with it.
There are a lot of different ways to love and play golf. There's the tournament way. There's the playing a member guest way. There's the being a guest of a club way, and then there's the way of going out with buddies you love on some level, and just slapping it around. And I think that Harvey would relate to all of those different ways.
Let's bring this focus right back to Harvey Pienick and his life. And one of the things I loved about your book, Kevin, was that it was not necessarily just a story about Harvey Pienick. It was also a story about the town and city of Austin, Texas, and the fabric of this place that evolved so much during the 20th century was just fascinating to read about and learn through the lens of Harvey Pienick. And could you just tell me a little bit about how central to the story you feel Austin is? Because I don't think the message of Harvey Pienick's life in your book would be as compelling if it were not for the existence in the story of Austin.
Yeah, that's a great point. So when Harvey joined Austin Country Club in 1912 as a caddy, the club was just a dozen years old. And his life in golf and his rise through golf paralleled the life and rise of golf in the state. Austin Country Club was the second established golf course in the state of Texas after Dallas Country Club. And Harvey sort of lorded over the growth of the game in this important golf state. If you think about where what golf means to Texas now, and then 100 years ago, that's where it all began. And Harvey was a part of that every step of the way. He was the first Texas-born golf professional, and he was just a part of that. So the city and the state necessarily have to be a part of Harvey's life story. And I very much enjoyed telling those parallel stories.
And the story of Austin continues today as this center for golf and for golfing excellence. You talked earlier about, or I mentioned earlier, Jordan Spieth, and he is a product of Texas, but also the University of Texas in Austin. And recently they held the match play did they hold the match play event at the Austin Country Club? Is that the same course that Pienick was the pro of?
Yes, it was. Now, there have been three different venues for Austin Country Club, and it's at its third now, the most modern, where it moved in 1984. This was after Harvey had retired as the head professional, but he still carried the title of professional emeritus, and he taught a lot of good players on the range at the location where the Dell Match Play was. But yeah, he was a big part. Harvey very much was central to the story that week, back in the last week of March when the Dell was here.
Right, and so much of that story was also Jordan Spieth, who didn't win that week, but being a Texas son, someone who went to the University of Texas in Austin, but is also somebody who looks up to Ben Crenshaw. And Ben Crenshaw, as you mentioned and as you wrote extensively about, was someone who, I don't know if you can say, made Harvey Pienick famous, because Harvey Pienick was well known before Ben Crenshaw, but those two, certainly their stories are now intertwined forever after Ben Crenshaw won his second Masters championship in 1995 after Harvey Pienick died. I mean, that moment will forever be etched in our minds as golf fans. And I can't help but think that the legacy of Pienick and Crenshaw continues today. in another Austin boy in Jordan Spieth.
Yeah, it definitely does. Now, Jordan was here briefly. He's from Dallas. He played his freshman year in 2012 when he was part of the national championship team that won at Riviera. And then he came back for the first semester of his sophomore year. But, you know, he knew it an opportunity when he had one. And that's when he turned professional. But, yeah, I think through extension, Jordan, the spirit of Harvey lives on in Jordan. But really, you really brought it up well with Ben Crenshaw's winning in 1995. Harvey was provincially well-known before that. Tom Kite had won the 1992 U.S. Open. But it was really that improbable Masters in 1995. In fact, Dan Jenkins called it the Little Red Masters. It was that improbable Masters in 1995 that I think permanently put Harvey in an American golf. Harvey died on the Sunday before the Masters. Ben Crenshaw was in Augusta when he learned of Harvey's death. He had been playing, by his standards, bad golf. He had just missed the cut badly in New Orleans, where he was the defending champion. And Harvey's death just knocked him off of his feet. But early in the week in Augusta, he and his caddy Carl Jackson were on the range, and really Ben Crenshaw was just kind of going through the motions out there. And Carl, his caddy, noticed two things. He wanted Ben to put the ball back in his stance a little bit, and he wanted him to stand over the ball just a little bit differently, and it just produced something immediately that Ben could ride into the tournament. Now, he came home on the Wednesday before the Masters began to serve as a pallbearer in Harvey's funeral. He flew back that evening and went directly to the club, and it was just him, Ben, and his wife, Julie. And Ben spent about an hour and a half on the practice green as the sun was going down. And as Julie and Ben describe it, it was a beautiful evening. In fact, a first-time player of the Masters that week, an amateur that most people remember, his name is Tiger Woods. He came by to express his sympathies to Ben as he was going to the clubhouse. But Ben was just all alone out there on the practice green rolling putts. And even Ben has a tough time explaining it, but he felt this this certain peace with everything, with his golf game, with his relationship to Harvey, even with Harvey's death. And he carried that into the next day. And, you know, he bogeyed the first hole, Ben did. But after that, he only made four more bogeys, the entire 71 holes left. And it was just an amazing thing. Like, how in the world did a struggling 43-year-old who just lost basically his second father, how did he win the Masters tournament? I mean, it's a question that really cannot be answered objectively. Even Ben struggles with it today.
Yeah, maybe we don't want answers to that type of question.
No, I don't think we do. That's a really good point. I don't think we do.
And maybe there are some things at work there. And I'll tell you, this was right around the time when I was getting into the game myself. And I was in high school, and you know, certainly Tiger was a couple years away from becoming Tiger. But for my generation, he was everything. But I remember the Crenshaw moment so much because Ben Crenshaw is the same year as my dad. So he and my dad are the same age. And I think for my father, who's a golfer and a golf fan, that was kind of one of those, you know, Nicklaus in, you know, 86 moments where it's, you know, this old guy by golf standards going out there and showing these young kids a thing or two. And it certainly made my dad feel differently than it did me, but I will never forget that moment. But I'll also never forget the name Harvey Pienick, because of how his life was and his career as a teacher was embodied by Crenshaw, and it was indelible. I'll never forget it.
Right. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people feel that way, John. I know that I do. I did before I even began this book. I mean, in a very big, tangible way, that's how this book began. It was 2012, the summer of 2012. I had just left the daily newspaper in Austin to teach at University of Texas at Austin. And I knew that one of the expectations as a college teacher was to write for publication. Most of the faculty, they do research and write scholarly articles for scholarly publications. That's one way of satisfying that requirement. But, you know, I wasn't a scholar. I wasn't a researcher. And so I was lying in bed thinking, what kind of book can I do? I want to write my first book now. I have this time and I have the expectation. And initially, I wanted to write the story of the 95 Masters. And so the next day, I called Ben Crenshaw's longtime friend and business agent, Scotty Sayers, who's a very nice man. And I dealt with him many times over the years. And I told him of my idea. And he said, you know, well, Ben's, you know, design firm is got a lot of projects going and we're doing our own book together. And I just don't think Ben would have the time to do this in a way that you need it done. And so I was discouraged. That night, I'm lying in bed again thinking, okay, that's not going to work. What's my next option? And it just occurred to me that I was really missing the point, like the long view and bigger picture. Why did the 95 Masters appeal to me as a story? Well, sure, it was that Ben won at the age of 43, but it was against the odds, and those odds were created by the tumultuous experience of Harvey's death in his life. You know, if Harvey had died a month before, or were still alive when Crenshaw won that Masters, it would still be a fine story because of who Ben is and because he was 43 years old and hadn't been playing golf. But what really, really made it a remarkable story was that he did it days after Harvey died. So it occurred to me that night, like, this is the story I want to do. I want to do the story of Harvey's life. And I knew his biography hadn't been done because I kept track of those kinds of things. I read every golf book that came out. And so that's how it began right there.
Yet you were amazingly able to interject so many cool, poignant moments from that 95 Masters. I love the behind-the-scenes stories about Ben Crenshaw the morning before his final Sunday round. Just had so much nervous energy built up that he's in the backyard hitting flop shots with pine cones before he goes to take the first tee. Those are the types of details that, as a golf fan, I just love. So you were still able to do that.
Yeah, that was really one of my favorite chapters to not just write but report. You know, one of the things that's really hard about being a third round leader at a major is the late tee time on Sunday. And how do you pass the hours until your tee time, 2 or 2:30 or 2:45 in the afternoon? So the Crenshaws, they had two breakfasts. I remember that's one of the things that the people at the house told me. And yeah, but they did go out and they hit pine cones with lob wedges. And then there was that incredibly poignant moment where Ben just kind of vanishes. And this is shortly after noon, the tee time's approaching. And Ben just vanished and he walks down this long driveway of the house they rented in Augusta. And he stood at the end and just kind of like let everything wash over him. As Ben describes it, he said a private little prayer, asking only for acceptance of whatever was about to come. And, you know, the range from, you know, completely losing the tournament on the first hole to what he did, which is, you know, holding the final putt to win by one shot. And he turned around at the end of the driveway and he literally marched back and he said, "Let's go." I love that story. And then also the story of the round itself, because so many good players were in contention. You had Davis Love, you had Greg Norman, you know, people were making moves. It was really one of those wonderful Sundays at the Masters when anything could happen. One of the, if I can humor you, one of the fun reporting experiences I had doing that chapter. I went to the Champions Tour tournament in San Antonio. It was the last one of the season. It no longer exists, sadly. And the tournament director is a good friend of mine, and he gave me a credential for one of the Pro-Am days. And so I had a list of players in the field in San Antonio who had made the cut at Augusta that year in 1995. And so I walked the 18th hole, which is a long, long hole in San Antonio. I walked the 18th hole with each of these players, asking them to remember for me every salient detail they could of that Sunday when Crenshaw won. And it was just delightful to hear what people like David Frost or Fred Couples or Jeff Sluman would remember.
You know, Ben Crenshaw went to the end of his driveway and asked for acceptance. I stand at the first tee with my friends and ask for forgiveness.
Me too. And I often do it at the end of the game as well, especially if we're in a money game. I ask for forgiveness on the first tee.
Well, I wanted to get back to to Harvey Pinnock and his book, his little red book, which is so perfectly titled. There were so many things that I was fascinated with his life and your story that I was totally unaware of prior to reading your book. And one of those things is the absolutely legendary life of Pinnock's, can we call him co-author or copywriter? Bud Schrake. Yeah. I'm pronouncing that right. Bud Schrake?
You are, yes. Okay. Yeah, Bud Schrake.
Bud Schrake, his life is, I don't want to say it's equally as amazing as Pinnock's. It's certainly different than Pinnock's, but his life, his personal story is fascinating. I had no idea that this Bud Schrake character was a Sports Illustrated writer, was a screenwriter, you know, producing movies, ends up, you know, with Ann Richards. You know, the future, I don't think she was when they were first together, but the eventual governor of Texas, right? And his story and how he came to gain the confidence of Pinnock, it was equally as thought-provoking and wonderful for me.
Agreed. I think we can safely say that Harvey didn't know the half of it when he went into his partnership with Bud Schrake.
Yeah.
They were so completely different.
Right.
I mean, Bud Schrake was this big living, you know, kind of bon vivant, who knocked around Elaine's in New York City with Dan Jenkins and George Plimpton. I mean, yeah, he was really kind of the antithesis of who Harvey was and what Harvey represented. But somehow their chemistry, their alchemy, was perfect. And what should be noted for posterity is that Bud Schrake had a lot to do with the success of the Little Red Book because of the way that he articulated Harvey's thoughts. The original Little Red Book, the scribble text notebook that Harvey kept for all of those decades, has something in the range of 6,000 words in it. And it's very disjointed and unconnected and stream of consciousness. They're just notes. They're not stories. And it's Bud. Bud is the one who put those in story form. So it's more of Bud's voice in the Little Red Book. It's Bud's interpretation of Harvey's voice in the Little Red Book. And without that, that book doesn't do anything. So Bud deserves a lot of credit for the success and the spreading of the Little Red Book.
But the fact that you were able to chronicle Bud's story, I feel adds an extra life to the tale of Harvey Pinnock. And it's, as a storyteller, you are able to get us interested in another aspect of this, the main character's life, which we were probably, most readers were unaware of beforehand. And you know, outside of just the story of Pinnock himself, I just think as a teller of tales, you did a fantastic job with the character of Bud Schrake. I call him a character because he is a larger than life character. But in describing his involvement in the Little Red Book, you really just open up our eyes and ears to just a whole new perspective, which I thought was very wonderful.
Thanks. And it had to be that way, John, because of the credit that Bud deserves in making the Little Red Book what it was. But, you know, so in Harvey's story, it really is the confluence of these two lives that produced this amazing thing called The Little Red Book. So I think Bud's life needed to be a part of this because of what he meant to that project.
And I want to make sure I get this quote right, but I think it was, this is Harvey Pienick. I don't know if this was in the jacket of The Little Red Book. I don't know if this was when they were doing press for The Little Red Book or when this was, but I believe his quote was, if they read my book, they are my pupil, and if they play golf, they are my friend. Did I get that right? I don't know when that was in the evolution of this Little Red Book, but I read that in your book, and I thought it was a great distinction and one that I think all golf fans and lovers of sport can appreciate and understand.
Yeah, isn't that nice? So how that happened, Harvey was signing his books, his Little Red, and he began using that inscription. And when Bud recognized the marketing and sales potential of a second book, became The Green, he knew a good title when he saw one. You know, Bud was all about wordcraft. He was a wordsmith. And so he knew immediately when he saw that inscription, that's the title of the next book.
And it's something to keep in mind, you know, for all of us, as far as the appeal, the allure of golf is based so much in not, you know, the prowess of your own game, but the fact that you get to spend 4 or 5 hours with some of your closest friends and family is why people will always come back to the game. And it sounds like why, you know, Pienick enjoyed, you know, teaching the sport as much as he did. The fact that, you know, he got to be surrounded by not just pupils, but by people he cared so deeply about.
Yeah, it's the greatest expression of inclusion. Harvey, as you know, taught a lot of women. He taught a lot of children. He was probably the most egalitarian teacher of sports we've ever known. It didn't matter where you came from, which side of the tracks. It didn't matter whether you're a woman or a man. All that mattered is that you loved golf and wanted to get better. If you could give Harvey that assurance, then you were in good stead with
him. I gotta, before I let you go here, Kevin, I've got to ask you, I don't know if the semester is still going on here at Texas, but could you, if it is, lie to us even if it isn't, but okay. what are we teaching in some of your courses this week? Give us a glimpse into the lesson plan for this upcoming week.
Okay, so 2 weeks left, John. And I view teaching a college class as a flight. And the first couple of weeks, you're taking off, you're leaving the runway, you're gaining altitude, spend the bulk of the semester, maybe 10 or 12 weeks at altitude doing high-level stuff. And so we come down kind of slowly. So we started our descent, and we're kind of wrapping things up. We're talking about big-picture ideas to take forward. I have a lot of seniors in my classes, so getting ready to graduate. I want them to know what they face, but I want them also to be confident in that and go forward. So we're wrapping up right now.
Well, we're going to wrap up here as well. And Kevin, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk about your book, Harvey Pienick, and you know, just about the game of golf in general. And it's a fascinating read, and it's a, as I said earlier, it's a great biography, but it's even better storytelling, and so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about it.
Oh, it's been my sincere pleasure, John. It's been a great time. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com.